Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jeffries, and I am your host for Bookin', presented by Quail Ridge Books, Raleigh's trusted community bookstore. My guest today is Jacob Tobia, a member of the Forbes 30 Under 30, the Out 100, a co-producer and host of Queer 2.0 on NBC News, a member of the Biden Foundation's Advisory Council for Advancing LGBTQ Equality, and the Clinton Initiative Honor Roll. Most recently, they are the author of Sissy, a coming-of-gender story released by Putnam Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Jacob, welcome to the program.
I'm so stoked to be here because I grew up like going to Harry Potter release parties at Quail Ridge Books. Like, I'm a Raleigh brat or a cool kid. I don't know, however you want to describe it. And so, you know, doing like my reading, like my debut reading at Quail Ridge Books has like basically been a dream for my entire life. And I'm just so thrilled to be here tonight.
Excellent. And it's an honor to have you here, Jacob. So my first question for you is, what do you have against pumpkins?
So, you know, I knew when I wrote that passage, there's a section of the book where I talk about how certain children for Halloween choose to just be vegetables. And I knew that that was going to cause a lot of controversy because I, you know, have some opinions about that, because my feeling, but this is my temperament as a Leo and as someone who's very performative about every aspect of who they are. You know, my opinion is that for Halloween, you should pick something that you can't embody in any other given day, and that children should be able to dress like their favorite vegetable just like every Thursday of the week. It's not that I'm against dressing up like pumpkins or zucchini or squash, any number of gourds, anything in the gourd family, tomatoes. I'm open to many vegetables, actually. It's just that I wish that we lived in a world where children could dress like whatever vegetable or fruit they wanted to casually and didn't have to use their one Halloween costume a year on it. That being said, you know, as someone who tries to be a paragon of inclusivity, perhaps I missed the mark on that one, you know, because I think that there's a lot of people who are like, I dressed as a pumpkin as a child, and you are now invalidating my childhood. And, you know, that's the risk you take when you write a book, is that, you know, you're gonna hurt someone's feelings. And I think I may have hurt a few pumpkin children's feelings. But, you know, I'm here to say that I am a great fan. I want to set the record straight, or queer, as it were. And I want to say that I'm a great fan of pumpkins, squash, and any plant in the vegetable kingdom.
Great. And Jacob, what's your favorite vegetable?
My favorite vegetable? Well, that's... I think I might be too polyamorous to choose a favorite. I would have said avocado a few years ago, but now I'm thinking it might honestly be like spinach or arugula. Mm-hmm. Just salad. I just love salads. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a good answer. I think avocado is a fruit anyway.
Oh, yeah. But get me on the technicalities. I see.
There you go. Jacob, this book, Sissy, A Coming of Gender Story, shares your experience of self-realization and actualization as a genderqueer person, mostly in the American South, and even more specifically here in North Carolina. What was your motivation for writing this book?
Well, my main motivation was that I'd done a lot of writing about being a non-binary, genderqueer, gender non-conforming, trans, queer person. I use a lot of different labels. You know, sometimes people get frustrated because they're like, you have to pick one. And I'm like, that's like, you're missing the point here, right? The point is that gender should be more like poetry and less like, what is it called when you name animal kingdoms and stuff? There's a name for the science. Oh, it's escaping me. But like, you know, it should be less, it should be more like poetry and less like some rigid classification system. Anyway, so I'd been writing a lot about my journey with gender and what it was like to navigate the world as a feminine little boy. And, you know, I'd been doing it online. I'd been doing it mostly in kind of the personal essay format. And I got to a point where I got tired of telling snippets, you know, and I wanted to write something more robust. I wanted to tell, to the best of my ability, maybe not the full story, but a fuller version of the story. And I wanted to be able to navigate a bunch of different periods of my life in context with other periods of my life. And that's the great gift that books and literature give us, that the internet, I'm not sure, will ever be able to reproduce, is that when you put something out in a book, there's a start and a finish and a length and a girth to the thing, where you don't have to worry as much about, well, if I just write, tell this one story, is that going to come off the wrong way? Or is that going to pigeonhole me into this one type of storytelling or this one way of understanding? You know, you have a little more space for tangent. You have a little more space to go on a rant about Halloween costumes. You have a little bit more space to make, you know, to fit in a few more dick jokes, you know, and you also have the ability to tell stories that don't work without the conclusion and that don't work without the whole. And so for me, it was as much a lifelong dream to write a book, and as it was me wanting to expand beyond the borders of a 1,000-word, you know, viral essay.
Thank you for that answer. Perhaps building off of that question a little bit, you took great pains in this book to explain and comment on the experience of coming out and the cultural narrative surrounding the experience, explaining that maybe it needs a new name. For example, you suggest coming out of one's shell as opposed to coming out of the closet. Your experience, the experience of coming out of your shell, is not the tidy Mad Lib narrative that you lay out in your book, but several narratives and several experiences that take place over the course of several years. Can you talk about this? Is it an experience that will truly ever be quote unquote finished?
I'm committed to coming out for the rest of my life. And by that I mean two things. One, I am committed to discovering new parts of my gender until I'm an old, old, old lady. You know, I'm dedicated to continuing this exploration and letting my heart lead where it wants to go. And I want to do that until I'm a very old age. So the hope is that my gender works more like software. You know, where you keep tweaking it, you keep developing it, you keep figuring out what it feels like, and you continually transition. You know, we have this idea that for trans people, transitioning is a one-time thing, and it's a medical thing, right? And transition is so much more a social thing, but deeper than that, it's a spiritual thing. So I want to come out for the rest of my life. I don't want anyone to ever think that they understand the fullness of who I am, because I don't want to ever understand the fullness of who I am. You know, I wish that for everybody. I hope we live in a world where everyone's coming out until the day they die, because they're discovering new things. They're figuring out new things. And for me, the borders of where does my self-knowledge related to gender and where does my self-knowledge related to the rest of me, you know, end and begin, they're fuzzy. So my gender will be necessarily part of my self-growth. And the other reason that I don't want to talk about coming out as a one-time thing, and the other reason I know I'll be coming out for the rest of my life, is that sustaining oneself after you come out, right? Sustaining your identity in the world is an equally important and difficult task. You know, it's not easy to stay out. And that's why I don't like the metaphor of the closet, because it exists in this in or out binary. The narrative, A, isn't that clear to begin with about, like, how did you get in the closet? You know, like, I think there's this sense that people are just sort of there. And I'm like, no queer or trans person was born in a closet. You were backed in there by a predator, you know, like a serial, like metaphorically speaking, a serial killer broke into your house and scared you into the closet. You know, like I don't think that is generally what's understood about it. It's just kind of, oh, you're just there. And I'm like, well, then how did we get here? Also, closets are wonderful. So like, I would love to live in a closet forever, like literally, not figuratively. But more generally, there's this idea, okay, you open the door and you come out, and then you close the door, and then that's it. But the reality is that you come in and out of feeling safe enough to express your identity to the world over and over, iteratively, in different contexts and different spaces with different people. You know, I know so many queer and trans people who present very differently in one city versus another, who present very differently around their friends than they do their colleagues, than they do their chosen family, than they do their biological family. And the idea that that identity and the world's knowledge about your gender identity or your sexuality is like a static flip a switch and you're done thing, that's just not the reality. for me, coming out looks like having the courage, even on days when I'm scared of, you know, being harassed, or, you know, have had one too many person stare at me in public, or have had one too many slur hurled at me across the street. It looks like looking in the mirror, seeing myself in a skirt or lipstick or heels or earrings or whatever signifier of gender you may have, and making the decision to walk out the front door. You know, it's a daily process, and it won't stop being a daily process unless we live in a world without heterosexism or cissexism, without the assumption that people are by default straight or cisgender. So I'd love to build a world where coming out is not a thing, because there's no assumptions to begin with, because you don't see a person on the street and assume that they're heterosexual, because you don't see someone on the street and assume that they identify with the sex they're assigned at birth, because we don't care about assigning a gender to sexes at birth as much in the first place. But in order to build that world, we have to start coming out, or start talking about coming out, as a more iterative process and as a more nuanced process. It's how we get there.
Thank you, Jacob. In this book, you describe a transgender tipping point and even slap a trademark symbol on the phrase. This was a moment in culture and time when it seemed like everything had changed and like maybe everything was going to be okay moving forward. What was this tipping point and what has happened to it?
Well, the phrase "the trans tipping point" was coined by Time magazine in the summer of 2014, and I'll never forget it because I thought I was lucid dreaming when I saw the cover. It was in the summer of 2014, I believe June, when Laverne Cox was on the cover of Time magazine. And I remember the day that I was at, you know, I was at my desk at an internship and I saw it on social media, and I literally thought, like, wait, am I awake? Like, am I actually, I don't know if I'm awake right now. And I sort of had the moment of like, okay, pinching, like, okay, like, I think I'm awake. This is a particularly lucid dream. It was surreal because it felt so fast and so sudden and so triumphant. And indeed it was. But the thing that was kind of tragic about it in hindsight is that we all, as a progressive community, made a mistake in that moment of assuming that visibility was social justice, that visibility was social and cultural and policy change. And the reality is that if you look at American history, if you look at history in general, visibility for a historically marginalized community, visibility for a political cause, mainstream visibility is the first step. It is the genesis of a movement. It is not the movement itself. Getting a few trans characters on the cover of magazines and a few trans characters in television, getting trans people visible on a household level does not mean that the work is over. It means the work has just begun. And what we've seen since 2014 is an incredible and massive backlash, because once a community becomes visible for the first time, the people who love us and support us are as vocal as the people who are outraged that that is now true. And so you see in state legislatures across the country way more proactive anti-trans legislation and anti-queer legislation and a cultural backlash that we're still not out of the woods on. And the reason I say all this is not because I'm a pessimist. I say this because it's important to know that you're planning for a marathon, not a sprint. It's important to understand that we're in the middle of a marathon as a movement, not a sprint. And that marathon, if history is any indication, will take a century to make even kind of basic gains. You know, and that helps us understand, okay, how do we think about the timeline for this? How do we think about our self-care as a movement? How do we think about the way that we prioritize what our goals are? And how do we calculate making short-term wins at the expense of certain people in our community, you know, and over the long-term goals of everyone getting what they need? And yeah, so I think it's important to name that we're not at all done with this work, that trans storytelling will continue to be vital for generations as we redefine and get closer to the truth of what human gender actually is. Because there have been times in history where cultures around the world, especially indigenous cultures, had a deep appreciation, kindness, and inclusion of gender nonconforming and trans folks, where our identities were simply an accepted fact of life, if not a celebrated part of the community. And so I hope that we're going to be able to get back to our roots as a global people, and that we're going to be able to get back in touch with how gender actually works.
Thank you, Jacob. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors, and I will be right back with Jacob Tobiah. The Bookin' Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin' can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin', Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. I am back with Jacob Tobiah, author of Sissy, a coming-of-gender novel, published by Putnam Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Jacob, how and why did you get Monica Lewinsky to blurb the back of your book?
Well, Monica's someone that I had met through a few of my friends in New York, and I'm really inspired by Monica's activism. She, in so many ways, was patient zero of internet-based shaming and mass bullying. Her whole life was disrupted in a way that was cruel and ruthless, both by the media and at the dawn of the internet age, where mass storytelling and the speed of it became dizzying. She was absolutely, her story is one of being treated with incredible misogyny. And I think that the way that she overcame all of that, the way that she has become an advocate for people who are bullied and an advocate against bullying and against cultural shaming and for dignity and kindness is an inspiration. So, you know, her work, I mean, the work she does with Vanity Fair, the work that she does on so many issues, has really been a source of inspiration to me. And I'm really tickled and honored to call her a friend. And she was sweet enough to give me a blurb, which, you know, not everyone makes the time to do that.
True. Thank you. I want to ask you about religion, specifically Christianity. The thing that I was the most surprised about as I was reading this book is how much of it deals with the church. Mm. Maybe 50% or more of the book deals with you reconciling yourself with the organized religion and church that you grew up with. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, when you think about the stereotypes about how queer and trans people are supposed to be, you know, when I walk into a room wearing, let's see what I'm wearing right now, like little low-heeled saddle shoes, vintage 70s jeans, bright pink nail polish, a spiky bracelet, this weird glittery metallic vest, chunky 80s jewelry, and chunky 80s clip-ons, and lipstick, and a 5 o'clock shadow, people look at me and they're like, okay, like you're probably like probably atheist. You know, they look at you like, surely you don't go to church. You know, surely like you're not, you know, and if you did, I'm sure that everyone at your church now thinks you're a freak and doesn't like you. And that's not my story. And that's not the story of so, so, so many queer and trans people that I know. Many queer and trans people grow up in communities of faith that raise us and nurture us in ways that actually sometimes the outside world didn't know how to do. You know, when I was a child and I was a sensitive, creative, artistic little boy, the world made it, like, you know, my peers and school and the other institutions I had access to made it really difficult for me to be who I was, because being sensitive, no one protected a sensitive boy on the playground, you know, when he was being taunted. No one gave me permission to literally use my voice. I mean, I faced so much like harassment and bullying and all this other shit for being a singer, you know, and for being a boy soprano who wanted to sing before my voice changed. You know, I wasn't like a cool kid singing on a guitar in like high school, right? This was like fifth grade chorus back in the 90s when singing as, you know, a soprano solo as a boy in your fifth grade concert was to be condemned to incredible social isolation. But at church, they were like, of course you should sing. Absolutely. Why don't you star in an opera? We'll do one basically because we want you to, like, you know, to, well, I mean, there's another kid in my church who was also a really good singer and was a boy soprano, so he could also sing the role. But they were like, well, we have two, you know, kids who can do this, and there's no shame here. We're going to celebrate you for this gift that you have when the rest of the world is so busy shaming you on the basis of this not matching, quote unquote, your gender, that you don't even get the chance to use it properly. So all that is to say that my church was an unexpected source of affirmation for other people, right? Other people think that is unexpected, but for me, it makes perfect sense. Religious communities are chosen families. They're another version of chosen family for so many folks. And while it wasn't a road without bumps, I mean, it took time for folks in my church to know how to really kind of affirm and celebrate me in my present trans queer abundance. But we got there, and the story of my relationship to my church, and by my church, I don't mean the Methodist church globally, because that is a completely different matter. I mean my local church, the church I grew up in. My relationship to my church has been one of reconciliation and ultimately an incredible empowerment, because I didn't have to give up a home community that was so important to me in order to be loved and affirmed as I am.
Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about regional conflicts. Specifically, I attended North Carolina State University.
That's where my brother went.
Nice. As a graduate student, and you attended Duke University. It seems like your experience there was not fantastic. Can you tell us about your time at Duke?
Well, to get the full picture, and by full, I mean not even, to get a picture, you know, you have to read the book, because there's a whole third of it basically takes place during my time at college. But I will say this, because I assume, or at least I hope, that most of the listeners to this podcast are North Carolinians as well. That being a you know, radical progressive North Carolinian at Duke was hella weird. Because, you know, everyone's like, oh, you went to school so close to home. Are you just 30 minutes down the road? And I'm like, no, I functionally went to school in a melting pot of New Jersey, Connecticut, New York City, and California. You know, like, it's a totally different world, especially in the undergraduate population. And so many things shifted, right? Like, all of a sudden, my class status was totally different, right? Like, the way that sort of where I fell in the social strata economically was really different. And all of a sudden, you know, being, like, caring about economic justice became a much more niche type thing, and became a thing that was directly against some of the lived experience of some of my fellow students. You know, it was a real culture shock in a lot of different ways. But there's certainly stuff to love, and I don't want to act as if Duke was this terrible place. But I also don't want to act as if it was this wonderful place. It was, like I think many people's undergrad experiences, a complicated place. But for me, especially freshman year, it was sort of devastating, because the narrative we have culturally about queerness, transness in college is that, as a queer trans person, you don't feel like you fit in high school, and maybe you don't have a partner, or, you know, you don't get to date around in high school. Maybe you don't get to, like, feel totally cool in your gender in high school. But then you go to college, and then you get to properly be gay or properly be trans or whatever, and everyone loves you for it, and everyone celebrates you for it, and you get to get laid all the time, and it's awesome. And that just was not what happened. Like, my high school's gender politics were far more progressive than Duke's gender politics. I fixed that by the time I was there for 4 years, at least in terms of my presence as a gender nonconforming person not being something surprising anymore. That's the benefit of a sort of mid-sized school, is that, you know, if there's just one little unicorn on campus, by the time you're there for 4 years, everyone's like, yeah, we have unicorns here as a category of people. And it's like, no big deal. But yeah, it was complicated, and it was difficult, and I didn't realize how much pride I had in being a North Carolinian until I went to Duke, and how much pride I had in being a Southerner until I went to Duke. And my freshman year, like 2 or 3 months in, she had the audacity to shit talk hush puppies. And I almost jumped out of my seat. I almost lost my shit. I had this rage that bubbled up from deep inside my bones that I, like nothing I had known before. And I just, and I think I scared her a little bit by being like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You come to North Carolina and you shit talk hush puppies? Are you kidding me? You need to go back where you came from. And then I was like, oh my God, I just said that. And then, but it was a bigger thing, right? Around the fact that there are incredible and crushing stereotypes about what being a Southerner means. And I refuse to support them, mostly because I find them to be self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, when the rest of the country that creates the media we consume, for the most part, I mean, there's some television filmed in Atlanta. Back in the days when we had the tax breaks, there used to be some TV shot in Wilmington. You know, there's some TV made in Nashville. But the people making decisions about what TV gets made are all in Los Angeles and a few in New York. And it's hard because people look at me and they perceive that I ran away from North Carolina. And that's just not the story. I love North Carolina. If I could make television shows and connect to the literary world in the way that I needed to in order to sell this book, and still live in Durham with a wraparound porch, like, oh my God, would I? And I intend to, because you reach a point in your entertainment career where you're fancy enough that you can live anywhere you want, and if someone wants to work you, they gotta fly you wherever they want you to film, you know, or they gotta fly you wherever they want you to speak or whatever. And I think when I reach that point, North Carolina is certainly going to be top of my list of places to return to, because I love it. It's my home.
We look forward to having you back. Finally, Jacob, you spent a lot of time in this book writing about your parents and the different reactions that you garnered from your mother and your father as you were in the process of becoming more and more comfortable with yourself, especially publicly. One passage about your father that sticks out to me is in a footnote of a passage where he has an unpleasant reaction to your outfit over graduation weekend at Duke University. But in the footnote, you explain that he takes you to San Francisco as a post-graduation gift, and that he walks through the Castro district with you. And you ask in the footnote, have your parents ever walked through the Castro with you? And I have to say, and this story may embarrass my mother, but yes, I have walked through the Castro with my parents. And you mentioned the bakery right there at the corner of Castro and Market with mm-hmm. cookies and lollipops and breath mints and such, shaped like genitalia. And there's also a nail parlor called The Hand Job. And San Francisco is sort of famous for having weather that changes from block to block. And my mother was sort of getting tired of this weather and removing her jacket and putting it back on. And as we walked past the hand job, she starts going, jacket on, jacket off, jacket on, jacket off, which is unaware of what she's walking in front of, which is a long-winded way of saying that, yes, I have walked through the Castro with my parents, but tell us what it meant to you to walk through this neighborhood with your father.
Mm. I adore your mother now, and I hope I have the pleasure of meeting her one day, because that is a story, and it's more nuanced than mine. But yeah, you know, I respect and adore that parents are contradictions. Every single parent we have is a contradiction in some way, shape, or form, because our parents are people and nuanced and face challenges. And, you know, are imperfect humans tasked with raising another human. And so, you know, I give my parents great leeway and patience and empathy for everything they've had to go through in order to claim me and publicly and love me and affirm me publicly as their child. They didn't grow up in a world that taught them how to raise a kid like me. They don't live in a world that currently makes it really easy to walk around with their own kid without getting stared at or getting looks, you know? And the process of writing this book really helped me deepen that empathy more than anything else, because you have to be able to recount the story in a way that sees their perspective in every moment, and more importantly, that finds the comedy in that perspective. The irony of my dad simultaneously referring to really flamboyant queerness as like San Francisco shit, And then taking me to San Francisco for my graduation trip just isn't lost on me. But the actual trip was gorgeous. Oh my gosh. And it's weird because it alternated between, you know, spending time in the Castro and walking past the giant rainbow flag and all of the camp that the Castro embodies. And then going to Yosemite the next day and being surrounded by this classic Americana. And I had this moment where I realized, like, oh, these are both experiences of Americana. And I thought, isn't that something? Because I think the Castro has been a rite of passage for so many queer and trans folks to take their parents and watch them squirm a little bit and, you know, just get a touch of glee out of the experience.
I've been speaking with Jacob Tobia, the author of Sissy, a coming of gender story published by Putnam Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Jacob, thank you for joining me.
Absolutely.
Once again, I would like to thank Jacob Tobia for joining me. Copies of Sissy, a coming of gender story, can be purchased in-store or online at www.quailridgebooks.com. Our sponsor is Libro.fm Audiobooks. Please go to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's BOOKIN, to get 3 months of audiobooks for the price of one. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been Bookin'.